good horse, I called you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're listening to episode 537 of Unwelcome Guests, From Divided Brains to Divided Societies. I'm Robin Upton. This week on the show, we are continuing loosely from last week's look at the need to shake off hierarchical structures and the need to recognize pathological thinking for what it is, only we're returning to the traditional Unwelcome Guests format. It's two lectures by academics, both of which will reward re-listening. In our second hour, I think this is one of the deepest talks we've ever had on Unwelcome Guests, the roots and ramifications of our culture of hierarchy and control, by a retired history professor, Marvin Bram. He's speaking 7 years ago. Now, he makes too many points for me to summarise that briefly, so I'll speak more on it just before we listen to it. But he's similar in his conclusion that there is something very amiss with modern society, and he's not talking about decades or even centuries. He's tracing it much further back, and I find this a very welcome antidote to short-term reflexive thinking, of which there seems to be so much nowadays. Our first speaker, Ian McGilchrist, is looking, I think, at the same phenomenon of separation, but not within individuals in a society. He's looking at within the structure of an individual human brain. And he looks at the roles of the two different hemispheres, the left being the cold, calculating, abstracting, logical, computer-like half, which doesn't tolerate ambiguity, which doesn't perceive context and relationships, which can't do fuzzy thinking, and the right, which is more about relationships, which tolerates ambiguity, which has a predilection for the living over the dead. And although he's focusing on the individual brain, he looks at the impacts for society and concludes that what we call enlightenment was marking the ascendancy of the left brain over the right brain. The logical thinking, the reduction of the infinitely complex to simple mental models, so that law and simplified ideas of justice could be applied to it. And he suggests that just before the collapse of Greece and Rome, similar tendencies were evidenced, which should give us some food for thought. This is from November 2010.
Welcome to the RSA. I'm Jonathan Rowson. I lead the Social Brain Project here. It's a real pleasure to welcome today's speaker, Professor Ian Gilchrist. Ian is truly a Renaissance man. In fact, he'd be a figure of some envy if he wasn't so likable in person. Having read English at Oxford and pursued postgraduate research in philosophy and psychology, he went on to train in medicine, no less, going on to become a clinical director of acute mental services in London. He's a fellow of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, has a busy medical legal practice, and has been published widely in a whole range of journals, from TLS to BMJ. His latest book, The Master and His Emissary, The Divided Brain and the Making of the Western World, is a culmination of 20 years of interdisciplinary research, and has been hailed as a monumental achievement by critics across the board. We're absolutely delighted to welcome you here today, Ian, so over to you.
Well, thank you very much, Jonathan, for that introduction, and thank you for inviting me. I'm very honoured to be here today. And I'm going to be talking about this book, The Master and His Emissary. I want to talk to you today, actually, about the nature of existence. And I will be doing so in relation to the brain, not because I think the brain is somehow a more real or fundamental way of looking at things or gives us the truth about ourselves and life, but it can at least cast some light, I think, on the nature of our thinking and the limitations of our knowledge. I suppose in a way we're sort of stuck, aren't we, with two models that seem very typical of our age. One which lingers in biology is of a sort of scientific materialist one, which views knowledge as gained by making certain one fact and then adding to that. And one builds up a picture of an external world which is independent of our knowledge and of which it's our duty to become aware, almost as though we were machines that were passively receiving information. But of course the other is the postmodern flip side, which is that, you know, it's all, reality is really just in our heads, and we make it all up. Now I think that neither of these is particularly likely, and they seem a bit crude. And I think the first point that one would make, really, is that reality changes with the nature of the attention that we pay to it. Attention might sound a bit dull, but actually it's part of the process of creating whatever it is that we encounter in this world. And things change when they're put into the center of the spotlight of attention. They also change when they're taken out of context, which I learnt when I was looking at works of art and literature. And that they become something completely different once they're taken out of that context. If you take, this might sound a little bit sort of abstract, but if you think of something like a mountain, it can be, for a speculator, it can be a source of wealth. For a sailor, it could be a landmark. For a painter, it might be a many-textured form. For the inhabitants of a land, it might be the home of the gods, which is the real mountain. There isn't a real mountain that is separate from those different, if you like, interactions of us with the world. Although science sort of suggests that there might be one, which is the one in which we play least part. So context is very important, and indeed it's not just important in things like works of art, it's important in physics. We know that probably things that exist in terms of, you know, at the particle level, have their existence in a context, and arise out of that context. And the Human Genome Project, we're now realizing that it's not as simple as this gene codes for that. It codes for something depending on the context that it finds itself in. Context is everything in understanding. And it is in philosophy. Dewey, John Dewey said that neglect of context is the greatest single disaster which philosophic thinking can occur, taking things out of context. And of course, when they're in context, they need to remain implicit. So many of the things that we understand, we need to understand implicitly. We pick them up implicitly, we convey them implicitly, and when we make them explicit, we change their nature. In talking about the brain, I want to remind you of a little story in Nietzsche. He speaks of a wise spiritual master who governed a community so well that it flourished. And as it grew, he realized that he not only could not deal with all the concerns of state, but that it was very important that he must not get involved with aspects of them if he was to retain his ability to see things that were of the utmost importance. So he appointed his brightest and best minister to be his emissary and to go abroad doing his work on his behalf. The emissary soon began to feel that he was the one that did the real work, and that his master was irrelevant. He took upon him the master's cloak, assumed his authority, and deposed the master. Unfortunately, he didn't know what it was that he didn't know. As a result, both master and emissary and the realm they both served fell into ruins. So just bear that in mind while we talk about things. This picture, famous picture of Escher's, is there, really to suggest that we don't begin with one thing that's certain and build on that, but that things come into being through a kind of interactive process. The attention we pay to the world changes what we find there, but what we find there changes the attention we pay. Similarly, we can't understand something by knowing one little thing out of context and adding another little thing out of context. We need to make a bit of a leap, as in the business of attending. There needs to be a kind of sense of what it is we're dealing with, because we need to apply a certain model. We only understand things by comparing them with something else we think we know even better. And in the case of consciousness, and in the case of the brain, it's difficult to know what that model would be. And when we don't think about what model we apply, we automatically go to default, the machine. The division of the brain is something neuroscientists don't like to talk about anymore. It enjoyed a sort of popularity in the 60s and 70s after the first split brain operations, and it led to a sort of popularization which has since been proved to be entirely false. It's not true that one part of the brain does reason and the other does emotion. Both are profoundly involved in both. It's not true that language resides only in the left hemisphere. It doesn't. Important aspects are in the right. It's not true that visual imagery is only in the right hemisphere. Lots of it is in the left. And so in a sort of fit of despair, people have given up talking about it. But the problem won't really go away, because this organ, which is all about making connection, is profoundly divided. I didn't make the division. It's there inside all of us, and it's got more divided over the course of human evolution. So the ratio of the corpus callosum, the band of tissue that you can see there, the right hemisphere has been pulled aside in this drawing to show you this band of fibers that connects the hemispheres at their base. The ratio of the size of that to the volume of the hemispheres has got smaller over evolution. And the plot thickens when you realize that one of the main, if not the main, function of the corpus callosum is in fact to inhibit. It's to inhibit the other hemisphere. So something very important is going on here about keeping things apart from one another. And not only that, the brain is profoundly asymmetric. Now, I'm not going to go into all the information in this slide. Just to help you orientate yourselves, you're looking at the bottom of the brain there. You're looking upwards, which is why the right is on the left and the left is on the right, just to make it a little bit easier. And what it shows is that there are asymmetries in the brain. Principally, it's broader at the back on the left and broader on the right at the front, and slightly juts forward and backward at those parts as well. And it's as though somebody had got hold of the brain from underneath and given it a sort of sharp twist clockwise. Now, what is all that about? If one just needed more brain space, one would do it symmetrically. The skull is symmetrical. The box in which all this is contained is symmetrical. Why go to trouble to expand some bits of one hemisphere and some bits of another, unless they were doing rather different things? What are they doing? Well, it's not just we who have these divided brains. Birds and animals have them as well. And so I thought it might be a good idea to have a look at what we know about lateralization of the hemispheres in birds and animals. And it turns out that this has to do with attention. And I think the simplest way to think of it is if you imagine a bird trying to feed on a seed against the background of grit or pebbles, it's got to focus very narrowly and clearly on that little seed and be able to pick it out against that background. But it's also, if it's going to stay alive, it's got to actually keep a quite different kind of attention open. It's got to be on the lookout for predators or for friends, for conspecifics, but for whatever else is going on. Now, it seems that birds and animals quite reliably use their left hemisphere for this narrow focused attention to something it already knows is of importance to it. And they keep their right hemisphere vigilant broadly for whatever might be without any commitment as to what that might be. And they also use their right hemispheres for making connections with the world. So they approach their mates and bond with their mates more using the right hemisphere. And one can see this because of the way the eyes are related to the hemispheres. So that is interesting as a starting point. But then you come to the humans. And it's true that actually in humans too, this kind of attention is one of the big differences. The right hemisphere gives sustained, broad, open vigilance, alertness, where the left hemisphere gives narrow, sharply focused attention to detail. And people who lose their right hemispheres have a pathological narrowing of the window of attention. But humans are different. The big thing about humans is their frontal lobes. And for those of you who are not neuroscientists, you might think the frontal lobe is just this bit of your brain sort of somewhere up here behind your forehead. But it isn't. It's about 35% of your brain. It's an enormously large chunk of your brain. And the purpose of that part of the brain? To inhibit the rest of the brain, to stop the immediate happening. So standing back in time and space from the immediacy of experience. And that enables us to do two things. It enables us to do what neuroscientists are always telling us we're very good at, which is outwitting the other party. Being Machiavellian is the word. And that's interesting to me, because that's absolutely right. We can read other people's minds and intentions, and if we so want to, we can deceive them. But the bit that's always curiously missed out here is that it also enables us to empathize for the first time, because there's a sort of necessary distance from the world. If you're right up against it, you just bite. But if you can stand back and see that other individual is an individual like me, who might have interests and values and feelings like mine, then you can make a bond. There's a sort of necessary distance, as there is in reading. Too close, you can't see anything. Too far, you can't read it. So the distance from the world that is provided is profoundly creative of all that is human, both the Machiavellian and the Erasmian. Now, to do the Machiavellian stuff, to manipulate the world, which is very important, we need to be able to interact with the world and use it for our benefit. Food is the starting point, but we also, with our left hemispheres, grasp using our right hand things and make tools. We also use that part of language to grasp things, as we say. It pins them down. So when we already know something's important and we want to be precise about it, we use our left hemispheres in that way. And to do that, we need a simplified version of reality. It's no good if you're fighting a campaign, having all the information on all the plant species that grow in the terrain of battle. What you need is to know the specifics of where certain things are that matter to you particularly. And so you have a map and you have little flags. It's not reality, but it works better for some purposes. One of the things about the right hemisphere is that because it has this broad open attention, and because actually it's more integrated with our bodies, it seems to have the vividness of experience fresh before it. It has what Heidegger calls presencing. Whereas the left hemisphere takes that information and uses it, disposes it in a clever way, simplifies it, and it represents it. And one way of talking about this is of something a bit like a map of the world, which has its uses. And language can be part of that map. It's tokens for things, words for realities. And in the left hemisphere of the brain, one sees this representation going on. Now, this I wanted to show you very, very briefly some pictures. This is with one hemisphere inactivated at a time. So on the left, you've got a tree drawn by both hemispheres. In the middle, you've got the left hemisphere's version. Notice the left hemisphere is only interested in the right side of space. You can see this on any acute medical ward with somebody who's had a right hemisphere stroke. They may neglect anything on the left because it's not of use to the left hemisphere. It's only the bit that it's interested in using. And you can see how exuberant the tree by the right hemisphere is. This is flowers, a similar picture, reduced to symbols, tokens, by the left hemisphere. These are all drawn by the left hemisphere, and as you see, on the left you have a cube, but it has no depth. You have a table, similarly. You have a tree, reduced to a few lines. You have a person, reduced to a formula. And you have a flower there, which is a purely symbolic flower. So that is the nature of that kind of reality. Here I just show that the right hemisphere has much more depth, less symbolic representation, more the actual in-depth experience. And here is an illustration from a book of Gazzaniga's showing after an operation, that's the lower level, after the commissurotomy, that's when the corpus callosum is divided so that the two parts of the brain can't speak to one another. Before the operation, obviously draws a very good cube with the right hand, but that information has come from the left hemisphere, because when it's cut off, look what it does. It's not a it's a flat representation. So there's something that's happened there to the three-dimensional nature of reality. Now, I haven't got time to go into all these differences, and I haven't got time to talk, unfortunately, about the asymmetries of the brain. There is a long, long chapter in my book in which I talk about all the evidence that I've gathered about the way it affects our, the asymmetries between the hemispheres give us different takes on the world. The newness of the right hemisphere makes it a devil's advocate. It's always on the lookout for things that might be different from our expectations. It sees things in context. It understands implicit meaning, metaphor, body language, emotional expression in the face. It deals with an embodied world in which we stand embodied in relation to a world that is concrete. It understands individuals, not just categories. It actually has a disposition for the living rather than the mechanical. And this is so marked that even in a left-hander who is actually using their right hemisphere in daily life to manipulate tools with their left hand, it is their left hemisphere, not their right hemisphere, in which tools and machines are coded. So this is very interesting. And it changes the view of the body. The body becomes an assemblage of parts in the left hemisphere. There's a different emotional timbre. I wish I had time to talk about it, as about how it affects our understanding of music, time, and the self. If I had to sum it all up, I would get away from all those things that we used to say, reason and imagination. Let me make it very clear. For imagination, you need both hemispheres. Let me make it very clear. For reason, you need both hemispheres. To do a kind of very schematic, rationalistic processing like a computer would, you can use your left hemisphere. But to reason fully, you need both hemispheres. And a lot of mathematical thinking and deduction is done in the right hemisphere. So if I had to sum it up, I'd say the world of the left hemisphere, dependent on denotative language and abstraction, yields clarity and power to manipulate things that are known, fixed, static, isolated, decontextualized, explicit, disembodied, general in nature, but ultimately lifeless. The right hemisphere, by contrast, yields a world of individual, changing, evolving, interconnected, implicit, incarnate, living beings within the context of the lived world, but in the nature of things never fully graspable, never perfectly known, as we think. And to this world, it exists in a certain relationship, rather than just an objective stance. The knowledge that's mediated by the left hemisphere is, however, within a closed system. It has the advantage of perfection, but the perfection is bought ultimately at the price of emptiness, of self-reference. It can mediate knowledge only in terms of a mechanical rearrangement of other things it already knows. Now, I would have liked to have time to read some extracts, perhaps I do, from this book, just to show you that actually what I'm talking about is not as abstract as it sounds. If we think about mechanism first, you know when somebody's right hemisphere is not working, they start to, that their world on the left is just produced by the left hemisphere. It's no longer produced by the right hemisphere. It's had a stroke. There's a description here of a patient by Ehrenwald, where the left half of his chest, abdomen and stomach should be, he's got only a wooden plank. It goes right down to his anus and is divided into compartments by transverse planks. Food doesn't follow the usual path from the stomach through the intestines. It, quote, gets sucked into the compartments of this scaffolding and it falls through the hole at the bottom of the framework. All this is only on the left side. So this is very interesting. And if you think about this virtuality, tokens for things, I really would like to read you this short extract about a whole series of patients, this was research done by a very prominent neuroscientist called Marcel Ginzburn and a Russian colleague called Deglin, when they looked at how people reasoned on, they gave them false syllogisms, and that means one of the premises is wrong, and what deduction do you draw? So, major premise, all monkeys climb trees. Minor premise, the porcupine is a monkey, which clearly it isn't. Implied conclusion, the porcupine climbs trees. Well, does it? They just demonstrated each hemisphere has its own way of approaching this question. At the outset of the experiment, when the intact individual is asked, does the porcupine climb trees? She replies, using, of course, both hemispheres, it doesn't climb, the porcupine runs on the ground, it's prickly, it's not a monkey. During experimental temporary hemisphere inactivations, the left hemisphere of the very same individual, with the right hemisphere knocked out, replies that the conclusion is true. the porcupine climbs trees since it's a monkey. When the experimenter asks, but is the porcupine a monkey? She replies she knows it's not. When the syllogism is presented again, however, she's a little nonplussed, but replies in the affirmative since that's what's written on the card. When the right hemisphere of the same individual is asked if the syllogism is true, she replies, how can it climb trees? It's not a monkey. It's wrong here. So there's that. And there's another very important thing about Lethem. He's a huge optimist, and it indulges in a degree of denial. So great is this denial. This is a neurological fact. It's not just an opinion I have about the left hemisphere. If somebody had a stroke involving the left-hand side of the body, their right hemisphere not operating, because it doesn't fit with the left hemisphere's idea of itself that there could be anything wrong with it, it will deny that there's a problem. It's not paralyzed at all. We'll move it then, and no movement will happen. But the patient will insist that they've just moved their arm. I just wanted to read you this little extract. So, an examiner talking to a patient. Whose arm is this? That's pointing to the paralyzed arm. It's not mine. Whose is it? It's my mother's. How on earth does it happen to be here? I don't know. I found it in my bed. And so on. And then when the hemispheres are, when there's a procedure whereby you can temporarily activate the right hemisphere, she goes back to completely accepting that she's got a paralyzed arm. But once that wears off, she goes back to, it's my mother's, nothing to do with me, Gov. So there's something there which is really extraordinary happening, which you can actually see happening, which is about denial. Now, I'm going to be very quick now and just talk about the broader implications of what I've just said to you. There's a problem here about the nature of the two worlds. They offer us two versions of the world, and obviously we combine them in different ways all the time. We need to rely on certain things to manipulate the world, but for a broad understanding of it, we need to use knowledge that comes from the right hemisphere. And it's my suggestion to you that in the history of Western culture, and I deal with this in the second half of the book, in Greek culture, in Roman culture, and indeed in our own culture since the Renaissance, things started in the 6th century BC, in the Augustan era, and in the 15th, 16th century in Europe, with a wonderful balancing of these hemispheres. But in each case, it drifted further to the left hemisphere's point of view. The Enlightenment specialized in separating the head from the body. In fact, the French Revolution developed a special technique for doing this. What I'd like to bring to your attention is Berlin's famous characterization of this Western way of thinking. He said there were three things which applied, in our view, to all knowledge. All questions can be answered. Anyone who's lived knows that can't be right. All answers can be transmitted to others. They can't. They're not information that we can be fed in, like into a computer. You need to draw it out of someone else who has to already have it in them. And all answers are compatible. If only. So when you come a little bit later to Blake, I put this up because it shows the picture of the spirit of Milton entering his body through his, as he says, through the left tarsus, going direct inspiration to his right hemisphere, in fact, in an area near the limbic system, which is the part that serves emotional understanding. Blake knew that opposites, innocence and experience, share something of one another. Nowadays, we live in a world which is paradoxical. It's very frustrating. We pursue happiness, and it leads to resentment, and it leads to unhappiness, and it leads, in fact, to an explosion of mental illness. That is the world we now live in. We've pursued freedom, but we now live in a world which is more monitored by CCTV cameras, and in which our daily lives are more subjected to what de Tocqueville called a network of small, complicated rules that cover the surface of life and strangle freedom. More information, we have it in spades, but we get less and less able to use it, to understand it, to be wise. There's a paradoxical relationship, as I know as a psychiatrist, between adversity and fulfillment, between restraint and freedom, between the knowledge of the parts and wisdom about the whole. It's the machine model, again, that is supposed to answer everything, but it doesn't. Think about this. Even rationality is grounded in a leap of intuition. There is no way you can rationally prove that rationality is a good way to look at the world. We intuit that it is very helpful. And logic, ethics, and aesthetics are all of this quality. We say that they're made up out of bits that we've now worked out. It's a utility thing, beauty and morality. But as Wittgenstein wisely pointed out, all these areas are transcendental. We have to make a leap of intuition to understand them. And this is not new. At the other end of the process, rationality we know from Gödel's theorem, we know from what Pascal was saying hundreds of years before Gödel, that the end point of rationality is to demonstrate the limits to rationality. There are paradoxes in logic. These are the great things in the Greek world that came into prominence about the time that we started to use the left hemisphere more at the end of that period. So reality is not linear, it's curvilinear, and there is a conjunction of opposites that we used to understand. In our modern world, we've developed something that looks awfully like the left hemisphere's world. We prioritize the virtual over the real. The technical becomes important. Bureaucracy flourishes. The picture, however, is fragmented. There's a loss of uniqueness. The how has become subsumed in what. And the need for control leads to a paranoia in society, that we need to govern and control everything. Everything that should be implicit becomes explicit, and the life is drained. Why this shift? I think there are three reasons, very quickly. One is the left hemisphere's talk is very convincing because it shaved everything that it doesn't find fits with its model off and cut it out. So this particular model is entirely self-consistent, largely because it's made itself so, and it's therefore very compelling. I also call the left hemisphere the Berlusconi of the brain because it controls the media. It's the one with which it's very vocal on its own behalf. The right hemisphere doesn't have a voice, and it can't construct these same arguments. And I also think, rather more importantly, there's a sort of hall of mirrors effect. The more we get trapped into this, the more we undercut and ironize things that might have led us out of it. And we just get reflected back into more of what we know about what we know about what we know. So I mentioned obliquely Donald Rumsfeld earlier, dreadful man, but a brilliant philosopher. It's not the things that you know you don't know that bring you down in life. It's those unknown unknowns. And I just want to make it clear, I'm not against whatever it is the left hemisphere has to offer. Nobody could be more passionate in an age in which we neglect reason and we neglect careful use of language. Nobody could be more passionate than myself about language and about reason. It's just that I'm even more passionate about the right hemisphere and the need to return what that knows to a broader context. So it's that business about the emissary going back to the master, not usurping the master. And when I'd finished this book, I came across a quote from Einstein that I wish I'd known when I was writing it. Because it turned out that Einstein's thinking somehow presaged this thing about the structure of the brain. He said, "The intuitive mind is a sacred gift, and the rational mind is a faithful servant. We have created a society that honors the servant, but has forgotten the gift." Thank you.
I actually managed to read the very long chapter you mentioned about the brain, because I run the Social Brain Project and I'm supposed to understand this stuff. But I find it very, very difficult and I very much enjoyed it, but it's full of caveats, qualifications. It's very much not left brain bad, right brain good. It's replete with lots of sophisticated nuances and insights and evidence. Everything is very carefully referenced and documented. So what I want to ask you is about the responsibility of you have towards this idea. Because now you're sending out into the world. And for those who are armed with your book and who can revisit this RSA talk, they may feel safe that they won't make these mistakes and make sort of simplifications and distortions of what you're arguing. Because it's such a powerful idea of human nature and human culture that it's very important that it's protected and that the idea is not sort of polluted or sort of adulterated in various ways, which is almost inevitable to happen as it's, you know, left out into the world and people start talking about it. So what I want to ask you, with a quick parallel, if I may, which is on Howard Gardner's theory of multiple intelligences. He had a theory of bodily kinesthetic intelligence. And once he went to visit a school where they said, "Look, we're doing bodily kinesthetic intelligence." And he said, "That's not bodily kinesthetic intelligence. That's just kids running around on the floor." Yeah. So what I want to ask you is, how do you guard this idea? How do you ensure that the power and beauty of it is kept sort of safe as, you know, as it unfolds in the next few years?
Well, that's a very good question. And I'm... very concerned about it. On a trivial level, I now found that when I go out to dinner with somebody, they tell me that their parking was screwed up because of their left hemisphere or their right hemisphere. And I don't altogether welcome this. I think I don't want to become the man who has a left hemisphere or right hemisphere take on everything, and I want to emphasize what you said, that this is a nuanced argument and it's not about bad and good. I do think it is difficult. The thing is, one can't guard against people misunderstanding it, but I suppose what I've put is plenty of flags in there about it, and I've tried to, as you say, give plenty of evidence. There's 2,500 papers referred to there. So, people can go away and look up what I'm saying, and I'm perfectly happy to have a discussion with anybody who can tell me, where I've gone wrong. So I think we just have to be careful about this, but I know it will be inevitably sort of dumbed down in a way, and I don't know quite what I can do about that.
Okay, fine. Well, maybe the audience can help you. We'll take that first. Thanks.
Thank you. How do long-term memories get stored, as it were, in the context of what you're saying about the right and the left-hand side of the brain? Are the memories fully formed, applied by the two halves, and what happens when they're retrieved to a damaged brain?
Very good questions. I mean, huge, huge topic. Memory, of course, in humans is not at all like, again, very misleading model, the computer model. It's not a fixed set of data that just sit there. It's a whole aspect of who we are, which is constantly changing and evolving and is also not just in a local store, but is throughout the synaptic connections in very large areas of the brain. And indeed, one could even talk about it being stored in the body and outside of the brain in certain ways. So it's certainly not a question of it just being sitting there in a data store. There are differences between left and right hemisphere memory. Right hemisphere memory tends to be more integrated with emotional meaning for us, and therefore with things that are truly autobiographical in experience rather than in terms of the sort of data about ourselves. There used to be a sort of theory that things were encoded in one half of the brain and retrieved in the other. I don't think that really stands up. I deal with it in a footnote in the book. But when things are retrieved to a damaged brain, they're inevitably altered. But then the whole of that person's world is altered. And I wish we could think, instead of thinking in terms of functions, we could think in terms of worlds. When people have mental illness, it's not just that a bit of data processing has gone wrong. They're actually inhabiting a perfectly coherent world that is just very different from our own. To them, it's coherent.
I'm James Kidner, director of Coexist. It's an educational charity. And I want to ask you where God sits in this great enterprise, because for much of recorded history, theism has, in a sense, mediated between these two sides of the brain, and I'm intrigued to know where, in a sort of increasingly secular world, that balance can be applied, and whether you think it has a role to play.
That's another marvelous question. I think that what I have to say does bear on those topics. I mean, I, again, wish we had more time to talk about it. I don't think there's very much to be said for the sort of idea that one could localize a God spot in the brain or anything like that. I do think, however, that the problem we have, at least with spirituality, we may have very valid reasons for being rather averse to certain religious cultures. But I think if you ask people, are they religious, about 9% say yes. If you ask them, do they believe in a spiritual realm, about 90% say yes. So I think there is something there that we all understand. I think what we're picking up is that there are things that are, that if you like, the right hemisphere is more aware of than the left. However, I do think that in our understanding, and indeed in religious experience, both halves of the brain actually play a part, and we do know that, and it's a big topic, but I don't think I've got time to talk about it at length now.
One more here, please.
Mr. McGilchrist, apart from what you've mentioned so far, is there anything sinister that those of us who are left-handed should worry about in particular?
Well, no. not at all. And lots of very highly gifted people are left-handed. Handedness is not a good indicator of anything else than handedness, really. I mean, it is broadly related to cerebral dominance, but so complexly that you can't really draw conclusions. 60% of people who are left-handed still have language in the left hemisphere. 97% of right-handers have language in the speech, I should say, not language, in the left hemisphere. So in the book, I do rather briefly deal with those issues. I think they, you know, left-handedness is probably associated with special talents and also special deficits, which is statistically a fact, probably because there's anomalous lateralization. So things start to behave in a slightly different way in our brains from the way they normally would.
On Start the Week, you touched on the difference between fantasy and imagination. Right. I wonder if you can just touch on your take on imagination, or is that really covered in the book? What's your take on imagination as opposed to fantasy?
Okay, well, I think, you know, for those of you who know Wordsworth and Coleridge, there's quite a lot there that would be a shorthand. But I think what they were keen to rediscover was that the constant seeking after novelty and sort of meretricious representation of reality, as in fantasy and fancy, were nothing whatever to do with imagination, which was more about clearing away all of that and seeing things for the very first time as they really are, or at least as close as we can get to that. So that was very much about re-engaging the right hemisphere apprehension of something. So, you know, Wordsworth bravely made himself a fool by staring at rocks and writing about it, and the bleakness of things, not the fanciness of things, became the residence of what he saw as the power of the imagination. So they're really very, very different things. And I do deal with it quite a lot in the book. So anybody who wants to know more, please read it.
How do you see the orientation of consciousness as distinct from unconsciousness?
Well, consciousness and unconsciousness is, you know, obviously a huge area, and both hemispheres partake in both. I suppose there's more of an affinity for the unconscious in the right hemisphere. This is partly because what we think, we mean many things by consciousness, which obviously we, again, haven't got time to, unfortunately, go into now. But one of them is things that are in the glare of the focus of attention, which clearly is, by definition, going to be this beam of attention that the left hemisphere brings to bear. And that has implications for the connectedness to the unconscious and the body of the left and the right hemisphere.
Okay, great.
Ooh, that was a big question to take on its own.
Sure. Well, you can add the God one in as well if you want.
Can I just add a maybe slightly bizarre question, but I'm just curious whether you have an opinion on perhaps or a theory about the reason for the what we might call the bilateral symmetry that we see at every level of the living organism. I mean, I'm thinking the obvious signs such as two hands, two arms, two legs, but also double helixes and so on at the cellular level. Do you have why is there this curious phenomenon? I just wondered if you had an idea.
Wonderful question. Of course, anything that moves around in the environment needs to have the symmetrical one would have thought it would be useful to have this symmetrical structure. But I suppose inside the body, things can become asymmetrical if they want to. And the interesting thing is why it has become asymmetrical in that way. But there's a rather profound issue bound up in this. There is a very interesting book by a man called Peter Barab, who has written a book called The Nature of Complementarity. And he sent me a copy of the book. It's another long read. But really what he's saying is in the world of physics, you can find really both types of reality, which my very poor understanding of physics would say might well be right, that there is a sort of, you know, a static, fixed kind of reality, and there is this quantum type of reality. And I suppose the big question for me is that how we find the world, even in physics, because our brains allow us to see these two kinds of reality? Or is our brain constructed the way it is because the universe profoundly is that way?
My name's Andrea Brooks. I train actors at master's level at a drama school, and which is part of the University of Essex. What I'm very curious about is, apart from perhaps staring at rocks, have you thought, do you practice, have you suggestions practical suggestions as to how we redress this balance, how we favor and build the relationship with our own right hemispheric understanding of the world.
I'm going to be a bit disappointing to you here because I don't really want to tell you what to do. I know from therapy that actually the first thing when people are getting things wrong is to raise awareness of what it is they're doing wrong. And afterwards they find the ways. If I try and tell you, I will come up with a very narrow list, which will be very much enclosed in what I can think of now. But what I'd like you all to go away and realize is that you're not condemned by some ridiculous materialistic philosophy that is instantiated in the structure of your brain, which is really just a lot of wires. You know, there are different ways you can see reality and start using the knowledge that I hope I've tried to convey, which is all factual knowledge about the brain from neuroscience. Use that imaginatively in your world. However, meditation is quite good. It tends to even up the balance a bit.
I was fascinated by everything you had to say. I'm very interested in neuroplasticity.
Yes.
And in particular, having seen Ramachandran talking about, he said, tricking the brain, where there's a phantom limb to deal with that. How does that relate to what you're talking about?
Well, look, Ramachandran is a sort of, you know, fascinating man who's done some absolutely wonderful work there. I really can't add to what those experiments reveal, which is fascinating. What I love about Ramachandran is that he's open to the awareness that there is clearly something profound. In fact, he said so himself about the difference between the hemispheres. A lot of rather prominent people do say that. So I'm hoping they will not be too frightened by my suggesting a possibility about what the difference might be.
Just to follow up on that briefly, because you also mentioned that the neuroscientific community have responded to you by basically saying there's nothing wrong with the neuroscience here. It looks perfectly sound to us. But we're a bit reticent to jump on board because it's so, I think, polymathic. Or, you know, just it's so grand in scope that they're a bit nervous about getting involved.
Fair enough. I mean, you know, it's a culture in which, you know, there's a great deal of integrity in the idea that you pursue ever more finely focused detail. And that has to be done. And, you know, it's enormously important. And I couldn't have written the book without it. But it does actually need to be set in a context. I mean, it's to do with us and our world. And we therefore have to rely on some minds being willing to, you know, I put my neck on the block, really, but to say I want to put this in a broader context.
On the premise that you... has the left brain usurped the control of religion over the last 5,000 years since it was developed?
Control of religion.
Or the power over it. Yep. On the basis that the right-hand side of the brain provided the yearning to develop it originally.
Good question. I was very broadly speaking, I would be sympathetic to that idea. I think things that start in wonder and awe, as indeed Socrates said philosophy should, and Aristotle said philosophy should, and indeed others have pointed out, as Goethe did, that it should also not only begin but end in wonder and awe. That has been put to the service of power structures. It's been codified, not always with negative consequences.
I haven't read the paper, of an fMRI scan looking at the top of the brain during meditation in which both sides go blue, meaning I think that they are stilled by the meditation. And I think there was a hint that this is the case for all faiths. Perhaps we are approaching a point where the point of faiths or beliefs, religious ecstasy, or can have some sort of correlate in the physicality of the brain.
Yes, sure. Actually, every kind of thing that happens, from buying a sandwich to feeling a sense of awe, is going to light up somewhere on a scan. You know, the mistake scientists make is that they think that after they've noticed the correlation, they've explained it. It's a philosophical problem.
Just a brief question. You cited an experiment whereby the right hemisphere was knocked out for a while and then the left hemisphere was knocked out for a while. I'm just fascinated to know how that was done experimentally. And could it be used practically? You know, if you could knock out my left side, I could start using the right side a bit more.
There are various ways. One is by something called the Wader test, where you inject barbiturate into one carotid artery and it knocks out that hemisphere for a short while. That's sometimes done before neurosurgery to find out which hemisphere has speech in it. In fact, in those experiments, it was mainly done by ECT because they were done in Russia in the days when it didn't really matter which hemisphere you gave ECT to. I mean, not so barbaric, it's a perfectly reasonable treatment, but it was just given alternately to left and right hemisphere. That's how it was done. You could actually do it with transcranial magnetic stimulation. You can actually suppress or enhance the functioning of one hemisphere.
Thank you. Struan Bartlett, this is about the making of the Western world, or should it be the unmaking? And what about the Eastern world, and how do they use their brain?
Very, very good question. I'm often asked it. At the end of the book, I do talk a bit in the last chapter about what we've learned in the last 20 years about the differences between Far Eastern brains, Koreans, Chinese, and Japanese, and their ways of solving problems, taking in information, and attending. It is very interesting stuff. It seems that they are more able to use equally strategies of either hemisphere, whereas we tend to be very deeply skewed towards strategies of the left only.
It's been a fascinating talk, but then you've been sitting on the right-hand side of our visual field where we have greater focus and perhaps less critical awareness. I was wondering, the history of Western Western technology has been of increasingly complicated tools. Possibly they've reached the point where they're too complicated just to grasp now. Does that give you hope that the left brain will have to take over some of the tool management from the right brain?
Oh, I see, yes. No, I don't think that helps.
Okay. You mean it's true, but it's unhelpful? Right?
It's true, but it's not going to help us. No.
And
I just wanted to know if the division was the same for children as it is for adults.
No, very interesting long story, but essentially in the first 2.5 years of life, the right hemisphere seems to be more dominant. In fact, language and speech come from... I mean, I had no time to... There's a chapter in the book called Language, Truth and Music, which is actually about the way in which music and language relate to one another and how we learn language and what it's there for. I hold it's not necessarily there for communication or indeed for thought. But there are differences and they do evolve. It's a bit complicated. It's a backwards and forwards over time as children grow.
Thanks for the talk. I wondered if you have any thoughts about improvisation in dance and music and sport.
Improvisation, I don't think it's lateralized. It's highly dependent on prefrontal cortex, and it's a wonderful thing.
Hi, it's a bit of a left hemisphere question, but is there a evolutionary selective pressure for the left hemisphere's dominance now? In other words, are we tending more and more to the left hemispheres for some evolutionary reason?
Oh, there is definitely selective pressure on left hemisphere development because, as I pointed out, it's the thing about the man with the hammer, he finds everything is a nail. Once you start looking at things a certain way, that's all that you ever find. And we're getting more and more into what I call the hall of mirrors. And we've now actually started to construct an environment around us which expresses the left hemisphere's view of the world. So we're actually getting feedback from the environment, which is very much of the left hemisphere's world, which locks us in.
If we gave you the power of benevolent dictatorship, how would you change what we do in education?
Fantastic. So given your immense erudition that you show in this book, plus the fact that it seems to have a sort of spiritual underpinning that some people are picking up on, if you were a benevolent dictator or an existent god, what would you do? What would you do to with this knowledge, and particularly with regard to education, but more generally?
Yeah. I mean, I think, first of all, education is vital. I think it's where the future lies for us. I'm worried about what's happened to education recently with targets and tram lines and all sorts of things. I think of all the wonderful people who taught me how they wouldn't even survive in this world. They'd have to have retired. And I think we've lost that. We need to be more trusting. It's a big issue these days. We don't trust people. We need to appoint good people, recognize their skill, and allow them to get on with it. And I don't want to be the dictator in the sense of telling them what to do. So I think that's terribly important. And I think we could incorporate different practices into the way we teach, which would open children's minds to other ways of looking at the world. One of the things that has often said is that children are indoctrinated into a spiritual view of life. There's a whole mass of research on this that shows that children naturally have a spiritual view of life, which is then actually indoctrinated out of them, contrary to what is often alleged. And actually nourishing that and allowing it would be enormously important and help with their creativity.
Ian McGilchrist falls back on a bit of a cliche there, I think. Oh, education is crucial, without actually squarely facing the fact. A question like, well, if you're in charge of education, what would you do, supposes that there is somebody in charge, that there has to be somebody in charge. Marvin Bram, our second speaker, is having none of this. He, in fact, closes his talk with a similar sort of reflection of what would he do if he were in charge, meaning what world would he like to see as regards education, and this is what he says.
But if I were a legislator, I would redo the school system from preschool, there wouldn't be any, through graduate schools, I don't know if I keep them or not, such that every day in the life of human beings going to school, they would express all their competencies.
A pleasantly forthright denunciation of the schooling system there from Marvin Bram, who, as we shall hear in our second hour, certainly has a very deep understanding of just how far back human separation goes. And although he doesn't make it explicit, obviously he's aware of some connections to the structure of the human brain. Just to return to one point from Ian McGilchrist, who said there is a selectionary pressure for left brain thinkers because we've lost the balance. Marvin Bram is the one who makes a connection between left brain thinking, left brain dominated cultures, and violence, and historically looking at the roots of what could be called modern global culture, stemming from the rather virulent and aggressive imperialism which came from empire after empire, stemming from what's called the cradle of civilization. I mean, this is not terribly new thinking. A lot of tribal cultures understand that there is this tension and seem to consciously manage to keep it in balance. Marvin Bram talks about the importance of size on the culture and the fact that beyond a certain point, people are unable to understand one another's different perspectives on the world. If the hierarchy becomes too large, the group becomes too far-reaching in its distance, socially speaking, then the people at the top really don't give a damn about the people at the bottom, because they can't understand their lives, and according to left-brain thinking, they see themselves as completely separate. Now, it's been a while since I brought the topic back of money, but it seems to me that is certainly the most virulent technology in terms of colonizing people's minds and spreading, as Ian Gilchrist said, the left hemisphere perspective. So we could look at things like economic literacy as being the part of money system iceberg which is above the surface, which is explicitly saying we are here to try and encourage people to think about the world in terms of money, in terms of the zero sum, the selfish maximization, and underneath that is a huge story of people's values being shaped by the system in the developed world, which most of them use innumerable times on any given day. Now, both of today's speakers are of the study hard and then tell what is going on persuasion, as far as, instead of offering advice, my advice would be, having understood this, to try to get out of the money system. My heart tells me that the money system is not long for this world, and we can see things like the hyperinflation is building. So another piece of advice for how to try to rebalance the left and right parts of our brain would be to try and avoid use of money, because money of its nature entails someone who pays, the boss, who therefore issues orders, and somebody who receives that money and is expected to follow those orders.
if we seek a world without hierarchy, this must be a world without those kind of expectations.